This morning we'd like to look at Psalm 149, verse 4, where the psalmist declares, "For the Lord takes pleasure in his people, and he will beautify the meek with salvation." Back in the days of the golden days of Greece, when it was the golden age really of philosophy, and all of those Greek philosophers were searching for the answers to give to others concerning life, one of the chief questions that the philosophers faced and sought to find the answer for was, why am I here? What is the purpose of my existence? One of their philosophers, Epicurus, said that man's chief good was to find physical and mental happiness. And so everything that a person did was measured as far as its relative worth as to how much pleasure it brought to you. And they lived fully for pleasure. The chief goal of life is physical and mental pleasure. The question of why am I here is a question that still plagues people today. For we are all looking for meaning in life. There's got to be some reason, some purpose of my existence, so that I can do something that will bring me meaning, a sense of purpose. This problem of our existence has only increased with the advancement of humanism, with its teaching of evolution. You see, what has happened is that the humanist, in order to get people to buy into the idiocy of evolution, have established a false premise as the base, and then they build on that. If you were taught as a child that 2 + 2 = 5, and when you went to school in each classroom, it was emphasized over and over again, 2 + 2 = 5. Ultimately, you would come to believe that 2 + 2 = 5, but you would be destroyed from ever being able to understand math. You would be destroyed from your ability to think logically, which is necessary for math, because you've established the wrong foundation, the wrong base. Now, what they have done is declared that you can have design without a designer. That given enough time, billions of years, all of the life forms with their intricate designs that we are able to observe could have come to pass by random selection and by chance. And thus, design does not necessarily declare a designer. Now, we know that that's illogical when you look at it carefully. If I would try to sell you on the idea that this watch of mine was the product of an explosion, I set off a stick of dynamite in granite up in the mountains that happened to have a few other metals in it, and as I went to pick up the pieces from this explosion, I found this watch that had come out of that explosion. It just so happened that the particles came together in that explosion just in the right way. And it tells me that it's Sunday the 25th, that it's 11:49 and now 11:50. And if I tried to sell you on that, or that I put a bunch of dirt and all in a washing machine several billion years ago, turned the thing on and just let it rotate and revolve. And finally, you know, when I opened the door, I opened it and look, what happened? No more dirt. I've got a watch, you know. And the thing runs. It functions. Now, we laugh at that because we can immediately see the fallacy of it. We realize that order doesn't come out of disorder. That you can't have a watch like this without intelligence. That there was someone who sat down and designed the circuitry and created this watch. But it testifies of intelligence because it has design. And so that design demands a designer. But you see, from the time your children have been going to school and from the time you've been going to school, you've been told that you can have design without a designer. And though that is wrong, you've come to believe it because you've been told it over and over again. But the moment you buy into that, you are now destroyed from any logical thinking. And thus, having bought the initial illogical premise, you're ready to believe anything. So here this past week in our newspaper, an interesting little article about the hairy-eared dwarf lemur that was photographed in Madagascar rainforest, one of the two most important rediscoveries of mammals in the decade. Relatives of the human have been found. The scientists have discovered this dwarf lemur in the Madagascar forest. The long-lost tree-dwelling relative of humans and apes has been found in the leech-infested rainforest of Madagascar. Now, the lemur is brown and shaped like a mouse, with a body 5 inches long and has a 7-inch furry tail, and furry tail, and it weighs no more than 3.5 ounces. Now you look at the picture of that and you say, well, that's sort of an ugly little thing. I have some relatives that look like that. But you see, having established the illogical base of you can have design without a designer, once you buy into that, then you say, well, yeah, look at that, relative to the humans. And you've lost any sense of logic or reason. And then with the hypotheses that I exist as the result of blind chance, I am here as the result of billions of years of these accidental circumstances that have transpired and the mutations that have taken place, and there is no intelligence behind my existence, then it really becomes a problem of why do I exist? You see, and I can find no reason for existence. One of the chief promulgators of the evolutionary theory in the United States today, and one of the most influential, is that of Carl Sagan. There's Carl Sagan. And Carl Sagan has influenced the government of the United States to spend several hundred million of your tax dollars in an effort to determine whether or not there are intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe beside the planet Earth. Given the hypothesis that man exists as the result of spontaneous generation, lightning upon matter in the right environment and under ideal circumstances several billion years ago, and then has developed through the lemur and the ape and so forth into man, it's very possible then that in the billions of galaxies and the billions of stars within those galaxies, that there is a planet, a solar system, where there is a planet that has conditions that would be similar to those upon the planet Earth, where perhaps a lightning struck the mud there and created the protein cell that began to evolve into ultimately an intelligent being, who probably in the same length of time since the Big Bang has evolved to the same standard of intelligence that we have. And if they are there, then they are probably curious, as we are curious, if there's any other intelligent beings out within the universe. And so are perhaps trying to contact us. Now, our government is also involved in spending of millions of dollars in sending coded signals out into space. Radio signals are being sent in a coded form into space. So in case there might be some intelligent being out there who is searching for the possibility of life somewhere in the universe, picks up one of these coded messages that are being transmitted by our powerful radio transmitters into space, and they listen and they say, dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. You know, it sounds like there's a pattern there. They are what they call non-random radio impulses that can be decoded and interpreted into a message. So we're sending out these codes that say, are you there? Is anybody listening? You know, where are you? Who are you? And we're hoping that perhaps if there is out there in some planet somewhere within the universe intelligent beings who have evolved to the same degree of intelligence, that they will be listening and maybe we can make some contact. And we have these huge antennas that have been set up around the world to listen for radio emissions from space. Non-random radio impulses that can be decoded into a message which, according to Carl Sagan, will prove that there's intelligence out in the universe someplace. He was one of the leaders and the inspirers of this big symposium that was held in Europe back in 1975. Gathered together the greatest minds and scientists in the world to determine if there are extraterrestrial beings, intelligent beings out in space, perhaps trying to make contact with man. He wrote a book which was a compilation. He edited the symposium that was there in Europe, and it was written and published by Massachusetts Institute of Technology back in 1975-76, in which he reported the seminars or the papers that were presented at this symposium. It was interesting to me in reading that book that the first paper that was presented was by a couple of American scientists who took all of the factors that were necessary to develop the first protein molecule to bring life out of inert matter. Spontaneous generation. And they fed into the computer all of the factors that would be necessary to bring to pass that first living organism, first cell. And the chances of that happening were so great, according to the computer report, that their conclusion, in the first paper, the conclusion was, it is impossible that life could exist anywhere else in the universe. The chances of it existing are too slim. They're infinitesimal. It's beyond mathematics. I mean, mathematically, it's an impossibility that life can exist anywhere else in the universe. Now, with that as information, what would your logic tell you? I mean, just being a logical, reasoning person, what would you say? If it is impossible that life could exist by chance anywhere in the universe, outside of the planet Earth, it would also be impossible on the planet Earth for life to exist by chance. But you see, they've already established that as the basis for the whole theory, 2 plus 2 equals 5. You can have a design without a designer. So you've eliminated God, and we are here. I mean, I can't deny my existence. And so, here I am, an absolute miracle. I defy mathematics. I'm an impossibility. But you see, having taken God out, you've got to come to that irrational position. But it's fascinating to me how Carl Sagan is willing to accept that non-random radio impulses that can be decoded into a message will prove intelligence. He's willing to accept that. And we know the Morse code. Those are non-random radio sequences that can be decoded into a message, and thus it proves intelligence. But take a look at that cell. And what do you have in the cell? In the genes, you have a non-random little, you might say impulses, non-random kind of design that can be decoded and has a message. And the message in it is how to replicate itself. And the message in a single cell of your body is so complex that it would fill 1,000 volumes of 600 pages. And all of the information to recreate your entire body is right in that cell. Now, if that would prove intelligence by getting some of a signal from space, ... if that shows that there's intelligent beings out there because you have a simple code that can be interpreted and translated into a message, can be decoded, and a message comes out of it. What about the message that's in the code? How can you have this intricate code within the cells without intelligence behind it? Surely they should see. But there are none so blind as those who will not see, and they don't want to see because they don't want to retain God in their minds. And because of that, their foolish hearts are darkened, and God gives them over to believe a lie rather than the truth. And professing themselves to be wise, they become fools because they worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forevermore. And so people today are living in this irrational position that you can have design without a designer. Given enough time, billions of years, and enough chances, it could happen. But what it does is it leaves people empty. Believing now that I am the product of blind chance, that there is no intelligence behind my existence, that I am here only as the result of blind chance, then the problem becomes all the greater. Why am I here? And there is just the answer. Well, you're there is no reason for your being here. You're only here by accident. You're only here by blind chance. There's no purpose of your existence. But that's not what the Bible teaches us. The Bible teaches that there is a purpose for your existence. That God did create you and that He created you with a purpose. And the purpose of God creating you was that He might have pleasure in His creation. Have you ever created something that you found pleasure in? Most of the things we create, the purpose of our creation is that we might enjoy them. We might have pleasure in them. You women that are adept at sewing, when you finished that shirt for your little boy and it came out right, you enjoy it. When you like to see him wearing it. You have pleasure in it. I made that. My sister's very, very skillful. And she used to make her boys their suits and everything else. And it was always just, awesome. And we would just, and she just enjoyed doing it. She liked to say, well, I made that for them. She had pleasure in her creation. And we usually do. You that are culinary experts, gals that love to cook. You know how spaghetti sauce is. Sometimes it comes out just perfect. You know, sometimes you get too much oregano or something and it overpowers and it's not a balance. But sometimes, man, it just comes out perfect. But then the spaghetti was, you didn't take it off in time and it sticks a little bit, a little gummy. Perfect sauce and gummy spaghetti. But there are those times when everything comes together. Sauce, spaghetti, it all comes together. And then as you watch him around the table wolfing it down and asking for seconds and all, you take pleasure in that. You enjoy it, you know. I made that spaghetti. You know, and you take pleasure in your creation. I take pleasure in creating things. I love working with my hands. I enjoy carpentry. I enjoy metalwork. I enjoy just working with my hands. And I take pleasure in making things. I take a special delight in sort of remaking things. I can go into a house that's been thrashed, is in shambles. And when I go in the house, I can see the potential. Someone has really messed this up, ruined it, but I can see potential. I say, look, all you have to do is move that wall there, and you could put a window in over here, and you could, and I can see all of the potential. And fixer-uppers, man, I love them. I'm tempted to buy every fixer-upper I look at because I love to just get in and show the potential and the possibility. Yes, I know it's a mess. I know it's a wreck, but there's potential and possibility here. I've had a secret desire for years to restore an old car. Now, I'm sure I'll never do it because I don't have time. And I hardly have time to tie my shoes, but it has always been a desire, a latent desire within me to restore a car. I think it's so neat to see these old vintage cars that have been restored to where they look like they just came off of the showroom floor. And yet they're 60 years old or something. And yet they look so great. And that's been a desire of mine. Just to take some old wreck of a car and just, work on it, rework it, until it looks brand new again. I'm sure that would be a very pleasurable thing that, and of course you can see when these guys are driving these things down the road, and they've got their little sporty cap on, and their loud shirt and all that. You can see that they're just taking pleasure. Man, I did this, I restored this old wreck of a thing, and they take pleasure in that, and I can understand that. And I think when we see the joy and the pleasure that one gets from taking something that's been ruined and making it over and making it like new, we're probably getting a little close to the heart of God, who loves to take those lives that have been ruined, that have been made a shambles because of the flesh, and to begin to restore and renew and make them over again into the image of his Son. And as he takes these lives that have been so messed up as the result of sin, and as he makes them over again, and as you see now that new life in Christ, the work of the Father, I'm sure that he takes pleasure in it. He did Job. He said, "Have you seen my servant Job? He's a good man. He loves good, hates evil." Took pleasure in Job. And he takes pleasure as he looks at you. And he sees that work of his grace in your life, taking you out of the ashes, restoring, making something worthwhile and valuable from you. For the Lord takes pleasure, the psalmist said, in his people. I think that the key words of the text are his people. For there are people in which the Lord does not take pleasure. God said he had no pleasure in the wicked. Paul the Apostle in Romans 8 talks about living after the flesh and living after the Spirit. And he says, for those who live after the flesh cannot please God. God is not pleased when you choose to live after the flesh, because God knows that that destroys you. God is pleased when you choose to live after the Spirit, yielding your life to him that he might, by his Spirit, conform you into the image of his Son. God takes pleasure in his people, so his people are those who live after the Spirit and who seek to please God. All men can be divided into two basic categories. Those men who are living to please themselves, and those men who are living to please God. You're in one of two camps. You're in one of two categories. If you take an honest look at your life, an evaluation of your life today, you are living to please yourself. Or you have chosen to live a life that will please God. And thus you measure your activities, like the Epicureans, by how much pleasure you derive from it, or you measure it by how much pleasure God gets from it. Does this please God? Would God be pleased if I do it? You know, we've been so busy trying to drive this narrow definition between right and wrong. Is it right? Is it wrong? Is it right? And that's not really the issue. Does it please the Father? I may be able to prove that it's right, but it may not be pleasing to God. Now, if the goal, you see, of my life is to please God, then I don't have to worry about right and wrong, because that's not the issue. The goal of my life is to please the Father, and thus, does this please the Father? Is he pleased when I do this? Does it bring pleasure to the heart of God? Now, I can choose to live to please myself. Most people do. I would say that the Epicurean philosophy is one that sort of dominates the world today. People are still living after physical and mental happiness. I mean, that's the chief goal of their lives and chief good. And there are many people that have fallen into that area of philosophy. But God can see the emptiness that that philosophy will ultimately bring to a person. That egocentric life can never be fulfilling, and that's why God seeks to lead people from walking down that path. For God knows that the result of it is selfishness in its extreme. It is strife. It's envy. It's jealousy. And it leads to fighting, to wars. If you're living to please yourself, then you're always wanting a little more, something extra. You become envious of that friend or neighbor of yours that has something a little nicer. You become jealous. You begin to strive so that you can get something nicer than theirs. And ultimately, you get into a fight. James says, from whence come the fightings and the wars? Do they not come from your own lust? You desire and you have not. And so you get involved in these fightings and in these bickerings. And thus, living to please yourself ends up with all kinds of misery because I want something nicer. Alexander the Great conquered the world. He sits down and weeps because there's no more worlds to conquer. Big baby. You know, that you live, but you see, there's no end to it. There's no fulfillment in it. Ceausescu is one more classic example of a man when caught in that trap is willing to rape an entire nation, allowing the people to go without, to starve, to have their lights on for 40 minutes a day and all, so that his wife can have 1,000 pairs of shoes and golden candlesticks. And that's what that kind of a choice leads to. Worse than that, Paul the Apostle said, if a person lives only for pleasure, they are dead while they're still alive. If pleasure has become your God, if you're living to please yourself, you're dead. Even while you may still be breathing and all, but you're dead. Dead to God. Dead to the things of the Spirit. And your life becomes a meaningless bore. Porsche had an ad a while back on the TV that you probably all saw, where here they are up in the mountains, beautiful, beautiful mountain scenes, lakes and trees, and she says, I'm tired of the mountains. And so the next scene is down at the beach and the lovely surf and all. And she says, I'm tired of the beach. I'm tired of it. And life becomes a bore. Of course, the punchline was, I'll never be tired of my Porsche. Well, that's not true. That's not true. Because when you make pleasure the chief good of your life, the ultimate result is a gnawing emptiness and a sense of worthlessness. And you end up a cynic and you say, life is not worth living. And that is very true of the life of the flesh. It's a correct analysis. Life after the flesh is not worth living. The pursuit is always the exciting part, but when you get to the end, then it's disappointing. Some of you may have become very successful, but you will be the first to testify that success did not bring satisfaction. Some of you may have amassed tremendous fortunes, but you'll be the first to testify that the great wealth did not bring satisfaction, fulfillment. We're moving into Proverbs, and of course, you have the classic example of Solomon, and we'll get there as we move into Proverbs, how that he was seeking for fulfillment and meaning in life. And he sought it through education. He sought it through wealth. He sought it through sex. He sought it through these other things. And he finally, after doing everything, running the whole gamut, he said, life is empty and frustrating. There's nothing worthwhile under the sun. That's true. If you live for your own pleasure. That's the conclusion you will ultimately come to. Life isn't worth living. But if you will choose to live your life to please God, Jesus is our example. Jesus said, I do always those things that please the Father. And when you make that as your choice, I'm going to always do those things that please God, you will find that your life takes on new meaning. It takes on new purpose. It becomes so rewarding, so rich, so fulfilling. To know that I did this for God and God is pleased with me. For the Lord, the psalmist said, takes pleasure in his people. What can I do to please God? In a sense, this seems like, again, one of those things that's just logically doesn't compute. Here's God, the creator of the universe, infinite, beyond our capacity to understand or to grasp. Created this vast universe with its billions of galaxies spread out over billions of light years. In one of these galaxies called the Milky Way galaxy, down in the lower corner, there's a little star called the sun. And around that star, there's a little speck of earth, dust called the earth. And on that little speck of dust, there are a lot of little microbes that are crawling around and driving Porsches and all. But how can I, this little bit of matter down here with a smattering of intelligence, how can I bring pleasure to that infinite God who has created and rules over this whole vast universe? And if you would ask me to give you some logical answer, I'm stuck. I can't. I mean, it's only that God says that he takes pleasure in his people that I know that he does. I would never guess that. I would never come to that conclusion. But he said that he does. And thus, I accept that. And I can bring him pleasure by being one of his people. But to be one of his people, I have to be righteous. And you say, well, that lets me out. I'm a sinner. I've made a mess of my life. My life is in shambles. I can never be righteous with the past that I have. But here's where God's love for restoring comes in. The remaking process. God likes to take that life that has become a wreck, that life that is in shambles, and God likes to begin his work in that life, remolding, reshaping, developing, until he brings forth that beautiful new model after the image of his Son, Jesus Christ. We, with open face, as we behold the glory of the Lord, are being changed from glory to glory into the same image by the power of his Spirit that is working in us. And God loves that. He loves that work of restoration. He's pleased with his creation and with his recreation. And thus, God has provided through his Son to take our sin, our sinful lives, the mess that we've made of our lives. And by our believing in his Son, he will forgive all of the past transgressions. And he will give us a whole new life. And he will count us righteous. God made his son Jesus to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God through him. And though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, that we through his poverty might have the riches of God. Such a deal. It's glorious. And so by being one of his people, I bring pleasure to him. And by bringing pleasure to him, I experience the satisfaction within. I bring pleasure to God by my simple childlike trust and faith in him and in his word. In the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, he tells us, as he's giving the hall of fame for the men of faith, he tells us about Enoch, who walked with God. By faith, Enoch walked with God, and he didn't die, but God translated him into glory. But before he was translated, he had this testimony, that he pleased God. That was the witness of Enoch's life. Well, there's the man who pleases God. And then the author of Hebrews added a commentary. He said, "For without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that cometh unto God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him." So by my trust in God, believing that God is and believing that God rewards those that diligently seek him, God is pleased. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. But your simple, childlike faith in God, I don't understand, I don't know what's going on, but I know it's in the Lord's hand and God's going to take care of it. And I'm just trusting the Lord to see me through. Oh, how the heart of the Father is pleased when his children place that kind of trust and confidence in him. My children never came home at night all worried. I never did go in and see them just sitting in their room looking despondent. "What's wrong, honey?" "I don't know if we're going to eat tonight. I don't know if you're going to put food on the table for me or not. I don't know. I'm just so worried. You know, I don't know. You know, I didn't see Mom fix anything, and I just don't know if we're going to eat tonight or not." You know. Well, they just expect to eat. You know, there was never a night in their lives that there wasn't food on the table. And there's never been a day in your life that God wasn't watching over you and taking care of you. "Yeah, but oh, I don't know about tomorrow. You know, but you don't know what I'm facing. You know, I just wonder if God's going to come through now, you know." But he delights, he takes pleasure when we have that trust. Well, God's going to take care of it. I'm not going to worry about it. It's in the Lord's hands. He knows all about it. He's working. He's going to take care of it. I don't know how it's going to come out yet, but however it comes out, it's going to be right because God is doing it. And God says, "Oh, that's my son, and I'm pleased in him. My child, for the Lord takes pleasure in his people." You might ask yourself the question, at the base of my life, is there that desire to please myself? Or am I driven by the desire to please God? Which of the desires controls me? For we are all controlled by one or the other. If I'm not living to please God, then I am living to please myself. The results will be disastrous if I live to please myself. If I live to please God, the results are joy evermore. The life of the flesh is death, but the life of the Spirit is joy and peace and life itself. Father, we
ask you to help us as we seek to evaluate our own existence and those motivating forces that control our life. To examine ourselves and to judge ourselves so that we would not be judged by you. To determine, Lord, whether or not we are truly living to please you. A selfless life, seeking to bring glory and honor unto you. Or if we have opted to live for ourselves and to please ourselves. God, deliver us from the destruction of the flesh and of the flesh life and its consequence and the strife and the envy that comes from that. And may we devote ourselves, Lord, to pleasing you. In Jesus' name, amen. I pray that the Spirit of God may have spoken to many of your hearts today, and that you will have determined, as I leave this place and as I go from here, I will devote myself to living a life that pleases God. I trust that that's your decision. And may the Lord establish that in your life. That indeed, the Lord will be pleased as he looks at you. His special work in you.